ABC Radio Australia.
The promising interim results of a third COVID-19 vaccine has excited people around the world and renewed hopes that the end of this global pandemic is near. Even the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, couldn't hide his excitement about the news of the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine.
The light at the end of this long, dark tunnel is growing brighter.
Unlike the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, the Oxford vaccine is cheaper and easier to store, which is good news for the Pacific because it'll be easier to distribute, which is important because easy and equitable access to a possible vaccine has always been a key issue for the WHO. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus again.
The urgency with which vaccines have been developed must be matched by the same urgency to distribute them fairly. The real question is not whether the world can afford to share vaccines and other tools. It's whether it can afford not to.
So what can the Pacific expect? Joining us now is Professor Fiona Russell. Professor Russell is an expert in vaccinations and is also on the Expert Advisory Group for the Vaccine Access and Health Security Initiative through Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning.
Fiona, as a vaccine expert, how do you feel about this news around the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine?
Oh, well, it's fantastic. I mean, this is absolutely very welcome news. I mean, who would have thought within 11 months we've actually got three vaccines who have, with their data showing that they're extremely effective. So it's extremely exciting, and there's many more vaccines that are coming that we hope we will have access to in the next year or so.
As you just said there, we're hearing the good numbers about how effective they are, 95% effective, 90% effective, 70% effective. And of course, we get very excited about this, but is efficacy enough? Do we need to know more about how these vaccines perform in different age groups, ethnicity groups, and people with pre-existing conditions?
Yes, absolutely. So many of the vaccines are being trialled. You know, these ones are, the main target group, is all ages, in fact, you know, particularly all adults and particularly the elderly. So, the vaccine efficacy data that's coming out so far is looking that it's very good, you know, for the high risk groups for COVID, poor COVID outcomes, in the elderly and those with comorbidity. So the safety data is being collected as well. And so there hasn't been any safety signals to indicate that the vaccine is unsafe. We will know certainly a lot more. The most important thing is, once they start being used in the population, the safety monitoring is ongoing. So, and that's in large populations that may detect very rare events that happen. So those mechanisms with regard to what's called post-licensure safety monitoring is extremely important to do and will happen following the rollout of these vaccines.
That obviously sounds like really good news. As a vaccine expert, do you have any concerns at all, and where do they lie with a particular vaccine rollout, perhaps in the Pacific?
Any concerns about the Pacific, you mean?
And in terms of the efficacy of these vaccines, as we know, like you said, we're still waiting to see how it will react with large populations in a general rollout. Are there any concerns there? And especially if it does go out to the Pacific with peoples of different ethnicities and different, as you say, comorbidities and things like that?
Yeah, I think, it's extremely important. Not many of the vaccines are testing in children. And, with the vaccine development, it's important to get safety data first from adults and then, progress down to children. So there's a couple. So Pfizer, the vaccine, the one that's got more than 90% efficacy, that's one of the vaccines that's announced its sort of results recently. That is involving teenagers, so 12 to 18-year-olds. And the Oxford vaccine also, the AstraZeneca one, is also being trialled in children. So I think provided it is safe and effective, vaccinating children will sort of come later. But at some stage, it would be important to include children because we know they do transmit. I mean, probably not as much as adults, but in particular, in the case of schools and, high density crowding in schools and things, you know, that is potentially, you know, where ongoing transmission may occur, and, you know, in large household sizes and crowded settings, that kind of thing. So that will come later on, not in the first instance, but later on. In terms of, you know, the other high-risk groups, so, you know, as we know, diabetes is very common in the Pacific, extremely common, but these vaccines are also being tested, as I say, in the elderly with comorbidity. So, but it'd be very important to monitor, obviously, any side effects and things at a population level once they are sort of rolled out.
Now, this particular Oxford vaccine doesn't need to be kept at super cold temperatures, which has been a point of good news in terms of rolling out potentially in the Pacific. This super cold temperature that it doesn't have to be kept at, what does it mean for the distribution of the vaccine in the Pacific?
Well, it means an enormous amount because we don't have to invent new ways of working. And so it can fit in with what's what's normally used for the routine infant vaccines, the same fridges and same cold chain requirements. And just to note that the Oxford vaccine, it's 70% or so effective with two doses at full dose. But if you give the first dose as a fraction of the first dose, a fraction of the full dose, and then follow it by a full second dose, then it's about 90% effective. So, so that's, you know, and so equally, pretty much equally to the other two vaccines that have been announced. So that's very exciting news.
The Australian government has previously announced this Oxford vaccine might be the one it would help roll out to the Pacific. With this good news that is coming in about its efficacy, do you expect that to happen soon?
Well, we know that with the arrangements the Australian government has, you know, they'll be getting about 3.8 million doses early in 2021, and then the plan, they have arrangements with the company to then make it in Australia through CSL, in fact. So all of those things are, you know, developing and happening at the moment. So, yeah, that's sort of underway. But just to note that, you know, there's a number of ways that the countries in the Pacific can access vaccines. So the first one is through COVAX, which is the global way, you know, through Gavi and CEPI and WHO, the global, you know, the global access facility, really, for all countries to have equitable access. And through that, governments can apply for, you know, to receive 20% of, you know, enough vaccine to vaccinate 20% of their population. I mean, the second way is potentially through DFAT, if countries request it, through this $500 million that DFAT has pledged to support our regional neighbours. And then also there's other partners who are supporting individual countries in the Pacific as well. And so they may be procuring vaccine. It's not known as yet how that will happen. And potentially there's other donors as well. So there's sort of, you know, that may come. So countries are having to sort of make very quick decisions, you know, very soon about how they want to, what pathway they want to go down. So having all the information you know, needs to be sort of put together very quickly in terms of for countries to actually be able to make informed decisions.
Now, one of the topics that has come up around vaccines is whether or not it should be made mandatory here in Australia. The Prime Minister has said that it will be strongly encouraged but not be made mandatory. And something that has recently come up is in terms of international travellers arriving in countries. Here in Australia, Qantas says it will be making sure that you do need to have a mandatory vaccine to board their flights and fly internationally. Is that one way Pacific countries, which are really dependent on international tourists, might be able to open up?
Yes, well, potentially, yes. I mean, there are precedents for this, of course. So, you know, there's the yellow fever vaccine. So certain countries, in, you know, such as Brazil and some in Africa, mandate that you can't enter the country unless you've had yellow fever vaccine. And then, you know, if you have travelled to an endemic country and you come back to Australia, you need to prove, you know, that you know, also be prove that you've been vaccinated and, you know, or if you've been there in the last 6 days when you've come back. So certainly, you know, there is a precedent for this. So this would be something that, you know, countries could consider. You know, the vaccines aren't 100% safe. So vigilance aren't 100% effective. as yet, and are probably unlikely to be 100%. So there's still, you know, potentially opportunities for the virus to get in, and particularly importations is, as we know, is one of the key areas, you know, key things, particularly when community transmission has gone to zero, but bringing in importations with travel. So that's certainly an option that countries will probably be considering.
And finally, Fiona, as a member of the expert advisory group, how do you account for long-term vaccine effects? You know, due to the nature of the pandemic, this vaccine can't do long-term testing, which normally happens in a vaccine development. So how do you account for this?
Well, the testing that's actually undergoing for all these vaccines is standard. There's no corners that have been cut. I mean, it's very important to realise. It's just that there's a whole lot of investment that's gone in. And so things have been able to be done faster because you can hire more people, you know, to do the work, et cetera. So it's not that any corners have been cut. So that's sort of extremely important to know. But we don't. The normal phase of development is exactly what's going ahead. You know, the phase one, two, and three, and then licensed are based on the safety and efficacy of phase three, and then the rare side effects and the rare things and the long term protection and all of those things always come when it's then used in the population. So, for example, we don't wait for the cervical cancer vaccine, HPV vaccine. We don't wait for 20 or 30 years of the clinical trials to show that it prevents cervical cancer before we allow, you know, people to have access to it. That would be unethical, you know. So we monitor, you know, we know that it prevents infection, you know, what the clinical trials have said. And so then it's up to the studies to happen afterwards to look at those rarer side effects and those long-term things that occur years later to show how effective they are. So that's a normal part of vaccine development. So there's nothing unusual about this vaccine, as I say, except for the haste that's been developed, but that's only because, you know, the pandemic and the immediate emergency of the need for the vaccine, but there's certainly no corners that have been cut in terms of bypassing any normal processes.